If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. My name is Jed Hearn, author of the fantasy books Across the Broken Stars and Fires of the Dead. And today I am joined by Rob J. Hayes. Rob is fantasy author of many books, including his latest release, the War Eternal series. Currently, two books from this series have come out. They are Along the Razor's Edge and The Lessons Never Learned. And a third book is coming out very soon. So, Rob, when we last talked, it was a couple of months ago. The world was quite different back then, very different. But since then, I have had the fortune of being able to read Along the Razor's Edge and The Lessons Never Learned. Before, I'd only read Never Die. And I think it's very fascinating kind of reading a completely different series from the same author, because you're sort of expecting, I suppose, a lot of the same styles or tones to come across. But The War Eternal feels like very different to me in a good way. So I was wondering if you could talk me a little bit through your initial ideas for the series and what it is about, to people who may not be familiar with it.
Okay. It starts off with the first book, which is very much about a young woman who is she was taken as a child and trained to be a weapon for her empire. She's a sorceress, so she's a magic user in this world, because of that power, she had that ability to wield magic. She was taken and trained to be a weapon in a war that her empire was fighting. But where the book starts is at the end of the war. So literally that war has been fought, and her empire, the empire she fought for, lost. And she is captured by the enemy, taken as a prisoner of war, stripped of her magic, and thrown in an underground prison where people are basically sent to be forgotten about, to mine out their lives in a pointless existence, and so she has to learn to survive in this hellish prison where she doesn't have the magic, the power that she's learned to rely upon over her life, and she has to sort of make some new allies and learn to survive and try to escape, because she's quite an angry character due to everything that's happened, everything that's befallen her in her life, she wants revenge. A large driving force behind her character is she wants revenge on everyone who put her where she is, at least very much so in book one. I think for inspiration wise, I wanted to set a series that were, or set a first book in a series at least, that was completely underground, because I felt that was a setting that is not used very much. I mean, at the time of writing it, I think I could name one book that featured an entirely underground setting, which is The Fade by Chris Wooding, which is a very different type of book. It's not a prison, it's an entire culture that has emerged to exist underground. And then after sort of writing the book, I found another one. There's Faithless by Graham Austin King, which is another book which is set entirely underground. But those are still pretty much the only ones that I can name personally. So I wanted to write a book that was just had this claustrophobic feel of this dark you know, sort of gloomy mine where nobody even remembered what the sun was like, you know, yeah. That sort of thing. And then, as for sort of the style of writing, because it's all told first person as an older character looking back at her life. And it's pretty much my first attempt to do anything first person, so hopefully it's done quite well. But it's from reading books like Mark Lawrence's Prince of Thorns and you know, Robin Hobb's Farseer trilogy and books like that. I wanted to give first person a go. I wanted to branch out into that sort of slightly different narrative style, basically. Because as I say, it's something I've not done before, and I like trying different things.
That's definitely a theme that I see with all of your writing, because you have, is it over a dozen novels out at this stage?
Oh, yeah. I think about 14 now.
Up to 14. That's insane. And you have, like, such a big variety between those, because you've got, like, sort of pirate stuff, you've got sort of Japanese-inspired samurai stuff, and then you've got, yeah, The War Eternal, which is a completely different thing. I want to tie back to that thing you were mentioning about the magic system, because I love a good magic system. And particularly hard magic, where you can really dig your teeth into understanding how it works and it feels very realistic within the context of a fantasy world. And the magic of sorcery, I just love it so much, because I think I remember reading a little blog post you did about talking how you were looking, correct me if I'm wrong with this, but my memory was that you were looking at the word sorcery and then you were thinking about putting a U in there, so that they're drawing from a source. Is that correct, or have I just remembered that?
Yeah, I quite like hard magic systems as well. I like magic to have rules. Otherwise, it just, when it doesn't have rules, it becomes too powerful, and it sort of, and if anything can happen, then I feel it just removes tension from the situation. Yes. I always remember was it Feist's series, the one with Pug. I can't even remember the name of it now. Really, but it kind of felt like the very ending to that series. Basically, the main character just went, "We win," and that kind of bored me a little bit. So yeah, I like magic systems. As for the sorcery, I like the idea that the magic comes from something.
Yes,
You know, instead of sort of being inside a person all along, it comes from something. So I know it's not the first series to use the idea of magic has a source, and it's from that source that magic users are able to sort of draw it out. So it just sort of, and as the source is spelled with you, it just sort of seemed a natural thing. It's like sorcery would be you.
I'm shocked that no one thought of it before.
I think it has been used before, but
oh really? I haven't seen it, so it felt original to me.
But I don't think it's used very often, because obviously sorcery is usually just spelled with the O. I just thought, well, it comes from a source, sorcery. Makes sense.
Have you had any readers tell you that you've got a typo in your book, like a couple of hundred times?
No. Yeah. Loads of people. There's been people telling me that, because I think it's mentioned in the blurb, there's been people that, like, you spelt you got a typo in the blurb, you spelt sorcery wrong. I'm like, no, I haven't. It's fine.
You're like, it's intentional, I swear. Read the book and you'll find out. Yeah, I love the idea of magic with a cost, though. And I think that's like a big credit to the system that you have in the book. Like, it's not this thing where magic, like you say, it's not this thing where it just solves all the problems with a click of the fingers. I mean, like, can you imagine a beloved series being solved at the end by someone clicking fingers, possibly while wearing a gauntlet? Would just be very unsatisfying, wouldn't it? But
it has an emotional appeal to the event. Yeah, it's kind of exactly. Like, well, we'll just undo everything.
Reset, yeah. Yes.
It's a bit of time travel to undo all the events that have just happened.
Have you done time travel in any of your books, or would you consider it?
No. I detest time travel. Don't get me wrong, some times it's not done too badly, it's done quite well, you know. I've read two books of Mark Lawrence's Impossible Times trilogy, and I quite like what he does with time travel there. It's a slightly different approach to it. And there's a couple of other things, like I watched the Flash TV show for a while, which was quite fun, just because, you know, watching Barry Allen try to time travel and just mess up the timelines is quite good. But for the most part, I just find time travel to be such a boring sort of, I guess, deus ex machina. It's just like that doesn't matter what happens, because the character can just go back in time and change it. And it just sort of removes, again, it removes a lot of the tension for me when it's just like, oh, you see a character die, and you're like, yeah, but they're just going to be brought back. It's not an issue. They'll just rewind time. It's fine. But it's not that it's that there aren't sort of good representations of it. It's just, for the most part, I'm just like, no, I'm not even going to touch time travel. It's boring to me.
Yeah, I'm very much falling in the same camp. I think unless it's like really tightly woven into the premise of the story, I'm generally not for it. But there is a form of time travel in The War Eternal, because as you mentioned, it's sort of the main character's future version looking back on their past and recounting what happens. And through that structure, you do have this sense of multiple timelines in a way of having the character describing what's happening, say, in the pit, and then flashing back even further from that point to when they were at a magical academy. How did you balance those flashbacks between past and present? Because I think it can be such a difficult line to walk, where you don't want the characters navel-gazing for ages, and you don't want the reader being more interested in the backstory than the actual story sometimes. Mm-hmm. So how do you strike that balance?
It was really tough in The War Eternal, especially in Along the Razor's Edge, because it's technically told across three timelines, or all timelines of the main character's life at once, because she flashes back to this time in the Magic Academy. She's telling what I like to call the sort of like the current timeline, which is her in the pit, but in reality she's a lot older looking back at her life, and she'll quite often drop hints about things that are to come. Sort of balancing all of that was difficult, especially with the flashbacks. But what I didn't want to write a story about a magic academy. I know they're incredibly popular, and I'm writing one at the moment, but we'll ignore that.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's a whole other story about the third book in the Mortal Techniques trilogy. Anyway, it's not a trilogy. That's just this ongoing series. I didn't want to write this sort of magic academy thing, but I thought it was quite important to get across her backstory, the main character's backstory, and how she had been, you know, taken as a child to be trained as a weapon and be taught magic. So I made sure that when those flashbacks are told, they're never told in a sort of a current storyline. You always get that feeling that she is talking about a much distant past, point in her past. So there's no dialogue in them or anything. It's more of a sort of recounting of what happened. And I made sure that every time she does give one of those flashbacks, it ties into the chapter that it's at the beginning of in some way, just to sort of like have that point of reference to anchor it all. As I say, it was very much an experimental novel for me. I had no idea what I was doing for most of the time writing it. The entire series, I had no idea what I was doing most of the time. So hopefully it turned out quite well.
Yes, well, I'm 80% of the way through. I'm 80% of the way through book two at the moment, and I can definitely say it's working for me so far. So fingers crossed that the ending gets nailed. I didn't even notice that, but you're so right. There is no dialogue in those like flashback scenes, and I didn't even notice it because it feels so seamless. But you're right, that is like such an easy way to distinguish it without doing anything annoying, like having it in, I don't know, like a different font, which I know some authors do.
Like the place of having it in italics the entire way through, and I was just like, no,
that's
this doesn't work.
I was gonna say, yeah, because like I know like Derek Landy and Scott Orie Pleasant, for instance, does that occasionally with his villain chapters, and then throughout the series the italics stop and it like sort of blurs the line between hero and villain, and it's cool in that regard, but I find it hard to read personally. So the series is coming out, it's three books and it's over 3 months. What made you decide to do this rapid release strategy, which I know a lot of reviewers and readers, myself included, really thankful for, but I'm curious as to what your thought process was.
This is entirely the fault of my fellow author, Ben Galley, who he wrote the Chasing Graves trilogy and rapid released that last year. And I was speaking to him at Worldcon last year in Dublin, and over a few pints, quite a few pints, he was telling me about it and how he felt that it was really, really quite useful in helping to push the book forward. There may be some Amazon algorithms in there that I'm not even going to try to understand, but we live in a bit of a binge culture at the moment where people like to be able to sort of like, you know, experience everything in one go. You know, TV series comes out on Netflix, it's the entire thing. People just watch it over a couple of days or whatever. And I think there's sort of an idea that's quite useful in books as well. If releasing it, a trilogy over the course of 3 months or whatever, or all at the same time, I don't know how you want to do it, but it gives people that idea that, okay, they finished book one, they loved it, they'll go straight onto book two instead of having to wait for 6 months or a year or whatever. So it was literally just a way of, I already had the series written, so it wasn't like, you know, I was trying to write really quickly to get the next book out. I had the series written for about a year, so I was just sort of okay. If this will hopefully help boost its signal, because in the growing publishing noise, there's just books coming out all over the place. So trying to boost the signal to be heard over it all is often quite difficult. So I just thought if this might help, we'll give it a go. And I've since learned that it is incredibly hard work and stressful as hell.
Why is that? Can you dig into some specifics there?
Yeah, well, so I decided to do this late last year with the idea that I'd be releasing, originally I was intending to release in February, March and then April. But at that point I had the books written, but that was it. There were no covers. They hadn't been seen by a proper editor yet. There was basically everything but the writing of them still to do. So I basically gave myself about 5 months to try and get 3 books ready to launch, which turned out to be impossible. So I decided to push them back a month and gave myself 6 months, which turned out to just be exhausting instead of impossible. So it was, you know, in that time, I must have edited myself the entire trilogy at least 3 times. And then obviously it saw my editor, Sarah Chaun, who, you know, she then edited it, and then I went through it again, and then there was getting the covers ready and then getting everything else in place. Oh, it's just exhausting. Getting one book can be quite tiring, getting one book ready to publish, but getting 3 ready to go in quick succession is just, it's absolutely knackering. I know people who do it throughout the year, they're just releasing one book a month, every month throughout the year.
It's crazy.
I don't know how they do it.
Me neither. That is, yeah, I have so much respect for them. And yeah, obviously it pays off and it's incredible if you can achieve it. What I find particularly interesting about The War Eternal is that our main character, Ascara, is not a particularly nice person. And for a lot of book one, we've mentioned this before when we were talking, I didn't find her particularly easy to connect with as a character in the first half of book one, but something for me flipped at the exact moment that she bonded with Serakus in the caves, which is about halfway through the book. I hope it's not too much of a spoiler to say it's basically this demon creature that sort of bonds with her, hoping that she will take him back to this sort of other realm that he lives in.
I didn't interrupt you right there. It's not a him.
Oh, isn't it a him?
No, Serakus is never referred to by any gender.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for correcting me. I guess that's just inherent bias on my part. So I appreciate... Yeah, you're right. That is interesting. But yeah, so anyway, I find that...
Serakus is never referred to by gender, which is a personal choice that I did on purpose. So anyway, that was it. That's just
I appreciate you pointing that out. I guess that is such a thing where you just sort of assume that people are behaving a certain way. and therefore it means things about their character. But yeah, it's not. So for me, I found from that moment onwards, it was just so much, for some reason, I just connected with the main character in that moment. And from that point on to, yeah, where I am at 80% of the way through book two, I just find them such an engaging and interesting main character. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how do you make readers like someone who is sort of an anti-hero in a way?
Well, it's a tough one with Scarlet. I know that I've had readers who just say she is not a likable character at all. She is compelling, but not a likable character, which I entirely understand. She was never really designed to be a specifically likable character. The series is very much about her learning to human. because of how she was raised and everything she sort of like went through, and her time in the pit, which is this sort of brutal prison, which isn't, you know, if she was a very nice character, she probably wouldn't survive it quite as well. She has to learn to sort of, you know, manipulate others in order to survive down there. So the series is very much about her learning to human, to be a bit more compassionate and to, you know, sort of like think about others. But I think a large portion to sort of making a character who may not be intrinsically likable will be showing their vulnerability, making them, even if they may not be likable, they are still, you know, human. So showing across that sort of human side, that vulnerable side. And I think the scene with Serakis in book one very much does that. And until then, she seemed vulnerable on a physical level. You know, she's a young girl in a prison who, you know, regularly experiences beatings and all that other stuff. But with when she meets Serakis, it's a vulnerability that goes beyond the physical. She is, you know, she is truly scared, and is helpless. She has no power at that point. She is completely at this thing's mercy. So I think a lot of it is to do with showing the vulnerable side of a character as well as their powerful side, as it were.
Yeah, I think that definitely works off really well. And you reminded me of something else there as well, which is trust. So when I was reading this book, probably the first moment of awesome I had, to put it sort of crudely, was when the characters started playing this dice game that you've invented for the story world. And I love board games in fiction. I've put them in my own novels. You know, you've got like Tack from The Name of the Wind, for instance, like features big in that. And I don't know what it is. I just find them like very compelling, and it makes the world feel very realistic. And also I just sort of want to play them and, you know, feel like I'm in that world. So can you talk me through a little bit about, first of all, like what trust is to people who maybe aren't familiar with it? And yeah, just talk me through what your thoughts are on putting board games into fictional worlds, and whether that's just like a way to add a little bit of detail, or if it is about like something, trying to say something more about the story.
All right. Well, I'm a big fan of board games in general. Hey. Board games, card games, all of that lot. I love them. Massive geek. So I when I created Trust, which is this dice game that the characters play in the pit. And the essential thing is you get three dice, and they have a number of different sides. They're not like, you know, numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's a side of friendship that depicts friendship, and there's a side that depicts betrayal. And then there's also four other sides. So when it comes to your turn, you pick another player and you challenge them, and then you know, secretly decide on either trust or betrayal. And they pick the same, so they decide as well. And then you reveal the dice, and if both people pick friendship, trust, they both keep their dice. If both pick betrayal, they both lose their dice. I think it is, yes. If one picks betrayal and one picks friendship, the one who picks betrayal takes both dice. And then there's a whole rolling mechanic as well. I'll not go into all the detail. It was based on what is it? It's called Liar's Dice, I think it is.
Okay.
Which is this? I think it actually that particular thing features in one of the Pirates of the Caribbean films. I don't know if it's called Liar's Dice in that, but it's all about you roll your dice in a cup and then you sort of like look at them and then you bid what you have. So you're like, I've got, you know, two twos. And then the next person around will look at theirs and be like, I've got three sixes. It goes on like that. And it all comes down to when somebody says, you're a liar. And then the dice are revealed. And then if it is a lie, then I think they take a dice off them. And if it isn't a lie, then I can't remember exactly. The rules, sort of the actual rules escape me a little bit. But yeah, it was sort of based on that, where it's this game where you're trying to figure out, you know, how the other person's playing, their sort of psychological sense, whether they're lying or telling the truth or whether they're trustworthy or not. So that's where that sort of came from. And I just sort of I wanted to create it because I like the idea of games in these fictional worlds. And I've used things like chess before or Go, which, you know, sort of like they're established real games. But I thought, hey, I'm going to create my own little game for it, just because, yeah, it helps bring a sort of sense of realism to the world, I suppose, that these people aren't just recreating our own games that we have in the real world. They're, you know, creating their own ones, which they probably would in a fictional world.
Absolutely, and especially I think what makes Trust really great for me is, first of all, I just love all your like bluffing, social deduction games, Werewolf, Mafia, or, you know, all those things. I love them. And second of all, it's such a thematically relevant game for what that story is about, because themes of betrayal and like who is telling the truth and who is lying and can you like put your faith in other people, that is such a big part of not just book one, but really Esker's arc as a character. And even in book two, you're still getting references back to, yeah, sort of, it might not be specifically Trust, but just sort of this idea of, yeah, like games where you have to put faith in other people. And I guess, yeah, what made it really stand out for me was that thematic relevance. And what I want to ask is, do you kind of, for me, when I'm like writing a story, a lot of my early parts of the process are about finding what the theme is, what I'm sort of trying to say, so that then I have that as like a filter to guide my decisions in other aspects of my story or building my world. Do you think about theme in that way? Do you think about it in terms of once you sort of know what your story's about, then you try to put in other details or, you know, character arcs or side plots or whatever that sort of feed back to that? Or is your process more sort of organic?
It's kind of a mixture of two of them. I'm very much a gardener, a pantser. I don't tend to plot everything out or anything like that. But I think that having a theme that you're writing to is quite an important step in the process. That doesn't mean you have to have it from the beginning. I'm sort of like halfway through a book before I'm like, that's what I'm trying to say. That's what this book is about. Which is part of, that's why editing is quite good. You know, you can then go back and be like, I can now add little bits that tie into it here and there. But I definitely feel that at some point you need to have an idea of what you're trying to say, what the book is trying to be about. I mean, it's all fine and well, you can have sort of popcorn books, which aren't really about anything. They're just about fun. But then if you want your book to have a sort of slightly deeper meaning, yeah, you need to have an idea of what it's going to be about so you can tie all the separate threads together. And that was definitely something that I actually had in mind going into writing Along the Razor's Edge. There are a number of themes that I, you know, touch upon quite heavily. Trust and betrayal definitely being one of them. Suicide being another one. Those are sort of themes that I wanted to write into the sort of the weave, the narrative of it, so that they were there at all levels, basically.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, you definitely see, like I said, a strong thematic unity to the different books. The setting in these books so far has been really great as a reader because, as you said, book one is very claustrophobic. It's all set in this underground prison. And then in book two, you open up into this sort of wider fantasy world and you have the characters going on a floating city, which is just awesome. I love it. What do you look for or think about as you're developing your worlds for your stories?
It depends on the world, very much so. But in this particular one, I wanted there to be mystery at the core of it. Funnily enough, this is something I learned from reading books by Brandon Sanderson and the like.
Love that guy.
I always held off reading a lot of his books because I was just like, oh, he's so popular, I'm not going to like him. But I read him, and actually, he's pretty damn good. but his worlds tend to have a mystery or multiple mysteries at the core of them. And every time you sort of like you, as a reader, you sort of learn this mystery, you solve this mystery. There's another mystery to be unsolved. It's sort of, in many ways, it's the J.J. Abrams style of thing. For it's like, what's in the box? And you spend this entire time going, what's in the box? What's in the box? And then you open the box and you're like, it's another box!
Boxception.
It's kind of like that, but a little more, you actually get to learn the idea, the mysteries. You get to peel them apart piece by piece, which is quite good. So I think that Brandon Sanderson does it a lot better than J.J. Abrams ever did, but there we go. When building this world, I very much wanted there to be mysteries at the core of it that would be solved as the character as Esker sort of traversed through the world, and then at the same time I wanted it to very much branch out after book one to be this much wider world that the reader would explore at the same time as Esker. So you hear hints of it in book one, but she's never actually been there. She's only experienced this very small microcosm of the world, and then she gets out into the actual world. And I mean, yeah, book two's mostly set on a flying city, or two flying cities. so it expands the world, and you get to, as the reader, you get to experience it at the same time as Esker, and I hope that's sort of like translate some of the wonder at seeing these things, this floating city, this wider world, these different races, different peoples, and cultures along the way, and the gods.
Yeah. Although, are they really gods? Only time will tell.
Yeah, that's one of the mysteries at the core of
the mysteries. I have to read book three when it comes out. On a slightly more, I suppose, serious note. Although hopefully we can turn this into a positive. You've mentioned on your blog that while writing book two of The War Eternal, that is The Lessons Never Learned, you somewhat struggled with the process. And I was wondering if you could just describe what that experience was like and how you got through it. Because I think as authors, it's so easy for us to just see the finished product and be like, oh, this author's perfect. They're a genius. They're, you know, amazing. And I'm not saying that's not true, but I think it's so helpful for writers, especially aspiring writers, to see how other authors have doubts and how they overcome that, because that's so much more useful than just pretending that authors are like these perfect people. So could you talk through that, please?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you'll be able to find a lot more information on my blog. Just going to pimp that.
I will link that in the show notes.
But yeah, basically, It was hellish because I personally was not in a very good place when I was writing book two. I just split with my publisher at the time, as an independent publisher, but I was, you know, I didn't have the rights to my books at that time, so I had nothing on sale. I wasn't earning any money. They hadn't paid me for a good year or any of my royalties. I felt like my career had just sort of dead ended, had stalled. So I wasn't in a very good place. And when I went into writing book two, I went in with the same mindset of writing book one, which was, I'm going to explore the world at the same time as writing it, and we'll see what happens. Which is fine when you're in a sort of a more positive place, and you're sort of like, I'm excited to experience it all, to go on the journey with the main character and everything. But when you're in a bad place, that tends to come through in the writing. So when I was writing book two, and I was just trying to go along with the flow, and I was feeling in this very sort of stalled time of my life. That's where the main character sort of, where Eska ended up being this sort of stalled part where she wasn't really doing anything and just being dragged along through the world by her bootstraps and wasn't enjoying it at all. So it really came across, and it was very negative, and I hated it. It was one of the worst times of my life. I struggled to write it. When I did finally get this first draft finished, I'd hated it. I sent it to my alpha readers, and they all came back and went, "It sucks," which I agreed with. So I put it on the back burner, and I was all ready to just quit the series right there and then. Then I wrote Never Die. I had this idea in my head for this fun story. My career started taking off a bit more. I was in the Spiffbo finals at that point with Where Loyalties Lie. And after writing Never Die, I picked it up again and had a look at it again. And I realised that it sort of clicked on me. It's like the reason it sucked is because I was in such a bad place and it just translated into the writing. So I decided to try and fix it. So I just scrapped the entire book two that I had written, which was 120,000 words or something like that, and just started again. But I started with a much better plan of where I wanted to go with it. I didn't plot the entire thing out, but I had a lot more idea of where I wanted to take it, along with both the themes and the settings and the things that Eska would endure and explore. So I went into it with a much more positive mindset. And a better idea of where I was going. And I think it turned out into a much, much better book.
Yeah, I definitely don't get that sense of stagnation to it. The plot moves really fast. I personally think that it's much tighter plotted and much faster paced than book one, which sort of makes sense because book one is all about stagnation within her life and being trapped, whereas book two is like freedom, flying places, adventure.
Yes.
And yeah, it comes across really great. So I definitely think you've turned that around a lot. If you had to spend self-isolation with one of your characters, who would you pick?
Out of any of the books?
We'll go any of the books, and then we'll go War Eternal. So any of the books first.
Oh, any of my books. I'd probably, I'd maybe say Anders from my First Earth saga, which is Ties That Bind, Best Laid Plans, and City of Kings, because he's a bit of a disgraced nobleman who he's an alcoholic. He just spends his entire time drunk and is witty and sardonic and an absolute arsehole. It'd probably be quite fun to spend at least a few days with. He might get annoying after a while, but at least there'd be booze.
Fair enough. At least there'd be booze and good jokes, hopefully. The perfect isolation companion.
The War Eternal, spending time with one character. I don't think it would be Eska. As much as I love her, she's very intense.
Yeah, that would be difficult. I mean, that's basically what the first story is, right? They're all in isolation in a prison underground and they can't leave. So sort of a good metaphor for our times.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe Tamura. Trying to figure out the riddles that he speaks in might be quite fun for him. He's always happy and jovial, even when the world's falling to hell around him and they're in a really tough situation. He'll always giggle at it.
Always the optimist. Yeah, he'll probably be like, "I survived much worse events when I was young." Yeah, I definitely think Tamura would be my choice as well. I thought you were going to say that, so. Very happy. Speaking of the First Earth saga, would you ever consider returning to that world?
I'm going to at some point. So it's only half done. There are six books out for it, and there's going to be another six books. There's going to be two more trilogies. I have this whole big overarching storyline, which is playing out in bits and pieces throughout the different sort of different series within the world. So one day I do intend to. I actually started writing the first book in the new trilogy back in 2016, and then it popped into my head with her story. So I wrote that instead. But one day I am going to return to First Earth and finish this 12-book saga. When that will be, I don't know. I've got plenty of other ideas and things that are going through my head at the moment which need writing. But one day I definitely will.
All right. Well, Miha is going to be very happy. That was one of the fan questions that I posted in
He bugs me occasionally, just sort of messages me and goes, is the next one coming out? It's like, I don't know, I haven't written it yet.
Yeah, nice. You'll be like, I would love for it to be out as well.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, give me three more of me in an extra couple of years and maybe we'll get to writing it.
Do you reckon you would like having clones of yourself? I think I personally...
I'd hate myself.
You would hate it? Okay. I must be a narcissist because I would personally like that. But maybe that's just because I'm an only child. So I would see it as my opportunity to have brothers.
I'd drive myself insane. I mean, I drive myself insane just on my own, you know. It's like there's plenty of times when it's like, oh, get out of my own head. So having another couple of me around being arseholes would just be really annoying.
More books, though. So that'd be handy.
Absolutely.
What is the first book, if any, that made you cry?
Yeah, that would be the second book in Robin Hobb's, what's the name of the series? It's not the first one, it's not Farseer. Is it the Golden Fool? No, that's the name. The Tawny Man trilogy. Yeah. The second book in that trilogy. I won't point out the scene, but anybody who's read them already knows what it is.
Great. I haven't read it, but what, like, speaking vaguely about that scene, what were the reasons why it provoked, like, an emotional reaction from you?
There's a character who dies, and it's a character who you form, throughout the books, you formed a very emotional attachment to. When they died, it was just like, that was, I cried, I put the book down.
Well,
it took a few days. it's emotional, and Robin Hobb knows how to make it hit, and it hits hard.
Right.
And it was, it's a devastating scene. Even though you know it's coming, but when it hits, it still just destroys you.
Do you think partly the knowing that it comes makes it even worse in a way? Because you sort of have...
Maybe, because you're hoping it's not going to. You know it's coming. But there's always that bit in your mind that's just like, no, stop it. Find a way around it. Stop it from happening.
Yeah.
You know it's going to happen. So when it does finally happen and that's it, it's taken away that sort of framework in your mind of just like, no, they'll find a way around it. They don't. And it hurts.
Excellent. Have you reread that book by any chance?
No, I've actually been meaning to reread the whole of Robin Hobb's Realm of the Eldlings saga. But it's finding the time. They're big books. There's a lot of them. And there's so many other books. My TBR shelf is huge. So it's finding the time. But I do. I want to get around to rereading those and also rereading Chris Wooding's Tales of the Ketty Jay books because I absolutely love them. But yeah, one day I'm going to find time to actually get around to it.
How do you decide what book to read next? Yeah, hopefully it's still good, yeah.
I pretty much, when I finish a book, if it's part of a series and I really like it, I'll pick up the next book in the series and read that straight away. If not, I will go and stare at my bookshelf and spend a while just sort of like staring at the different books going, and then I will just go, that one. I've been meaning to read that one for a while. Which is exactly how I picked Jade City, which is the book I'm reading at the moment. And it's just like, it's been on my shelf for a while. A lot of people have recommended it to me. And, you know, I've just finished Poppy War, so I'm on this sort of Asian fantasy role at the moment. So I thought, you know what? That one.
Makes sense. Speaking of...
That's pretty much it. I don't plan out what I'm going to read, like, in advance. I'm literally just like, ooh, what do I fancy? I've got a large enough TBR shelf. Well, actually, it's two shelves at this point that I can... spend a while choosing. There's so many different options.
There are a lot of books out there, and even more so these days. So yeah, it is definitely difficult to decide. Speaking of Asian fantasy, You mentioned recently that you are working on a sequel to Never Die, which is one of my favorite books that I've read so far this year. Could you talk me through a little bit about perhaps what it's going to be about, if you can, without giving spoilers, and yeah, just like what you plan for that series as a whole?
So the series itself is going to be a collection of standalone stories set in this world that I've created. It was never intended to be that way. I wrote Never Die as this complete standalone, but then people kept saying they wanted more. And when enough people say they want more, you're kind of like, all right then. And luckily I had this sort of like this other idea pinging around my head for one of the characters. So I thought, you know what, I'll write that story. So the second book, which is written and is with early readers at the moment, which is good because they're all coming back so far saying it's brilliant, we love it.
Nice.
It's called Pawn's Gambit, and it focuses around a character from the first book, one of the sort of secondary characters in the first book, who was called the Art of War. She was a strategist in the first book. Sort of based a little bit on, I'm going to kill the pronunciation here, Zhuge Liang? Anyway, he's a character from
the military strategy book, right? Is that the guy who wrote the military strategy book, The Art of War?
No, that's Sun Tzu.
Okay.
He's the real world sort of war philosopher who wrote The Art of War.
Got it.
Which obviously the character is named after. Again, killing the pronunciation, Zhuge Liang, is a character from the Romance of the Three Kingdoms Chinese epic, which is a sort of fantasy story. In fact, the Romance of the Three Kingdoms is a very big influence on the world of Never Die. I love this idea of sort of like these heroic warriors who are worth a thousand normal soldiers on a battlefield and all that. This sort of like Art of War character was loosely based on him. And then I had this idea to write a story about her. In many ways, it apes the journey of Never Die. So there will be gods, there will be a journey, and that sort of thing. But at the same time, it's a very different beast. But it's basically about this strategist character who has retired and is pulled back into service by a capricious god. The god of missed opportunities, and they go on a bit of a journey together.
Nice.
That's about all I'm going to say for it at the moment. But it's coming in January of 2021.
Great. I'm looking forward to that. Have you read, this is a totally random question, but have you read The Book of Five Rings by any chance?
No.
Ah, okay. I think you'd really enjoy it because it's sort of picking up on a lot of these. It's a real world memoir written by a 16th century samurai who was undefeated in like 60 duels, started fighting when he was 12, and this is his book about like how to win sword fights and also life. And it reminded me a lot of Never Die in a way. So yeah, that might be something worthwhile to look out for that.
Book of Five Rings.
What's that? The Book of Five Rings, yes.
It's really called Legend of the Five Rings, which is sort of set in a sort of Asian setting. So I wonder if there's sort of a connection between those.
Possibly. I have heard it is an inspiration for Avatar, although I haven't seen Avatar, which I understand is a travesty. So I will correct that. I know. I haven't read the Lord of the Rings books either. So.
Sorry, the films are good.
Yeah, films are great. Couple of quick rapid fire questions before we start to wrap up. This is another question from her. Will you be writing in any other genre apart from fantasy after your experiment with drawings, which was a science fiction thrill?
That's my science fiction noir cyberpunk thing about emotional harvesting. So that was a weird one. That was actually the first book I wrote in first person. I also wrote in Project Sense, which was just an absolute mind melt. I will probably write another sci-fi story at some point. I have a few ideas for some other sci-fi stories rolling around my head. They probably won't be another noir sort of style one. I have this habit, whenever I think of a sci-fi story, my mind automatically goes to cyberpunk for some reason. because, you know, growing up in the 80s and cyberpunk was like the thing. But I have a couple of ideas for sort of a space opera-y type thing as well. So I think I'll probably write in sci-fi again one day. But other than that, it's pretty much, I've got plenty of ideas for sort of fantasy, epic fantasy type stories. So different styles within those, like, you know, obviously there's the Asian sort of flavoured ones. Or sometimes I've got, you know, a steampunk type one. So there might be sort of variations within the genre, but I'll probably stick to fantasy for the most part.
Makes sense.
That was not a rapid-fire answer to a rapid-fire question.
Every time I do rapid-fire with an author, it always becomes long, but I don't mind because, like, normally the answers are quite good, so that's fine on me. Do you have a vivid early memory that showed you the power of stories? And if so, could you describe what that felt like to me?
I don't know. To be honest, I'm not very good at remembering. I have this really hazy thing about my memories sort of childhood where I remember the events around them, but I don't particularly remember I have a memory that I can sort of access and go, aha, this happened. So I know the reading Robert Jarvis? Anyway, the Dark Portal books, the Deptford Mice books, I think it's Robin Jarvis. And the first one was the Dark Portal. I remember reading those books, and I think it was in the second or third book in the series where my favourite character, they're mice, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is a random detail.
Yeah, it's a book. It's a fantasy book about mice, and the villain's a cat. It works. My favorite character in that died. And again, it was another powerful moment. And I think that's one that sort of really stuck out to me as an act of storytelling that has stayed with me over the years. You know, I don't remember a lot about the books because I was about 7 years old when I read them or whatever, seven, 8 years old. But I remember that moment reading that because it hit me hard. So I think that's probably the one that stands out most.
Interesting.
Memory's a really strange thing.
Oh yeah. It's kind of freaky to think about. Yeah. Like when you are a completely different person, when you form that memory and now you're like, yeah, it's a weird thing. Should write a book about it sometime. Oh wait, Drones has memories and emotional harvesting in it. Do you read your book reviews? And if so, how do you deal with bad or good book reviews?
I foolishly do. I probably shouldn't. but I mean, sometimes they can be helpful. You know, if you're reading book reviews and there's a lot of criticism about a certain area, then you can generally go, okay, maybe that's a legitimate sort of thing instead of just one person's opinion. So I do read them. I tend to read the more positive ones because we authors are egocentric. I don't know. It's one of those. A good review can sort of make you feel like you're less of an imposter, whereas a bad review will just crush you. So I try to look at them with an objective air where I try to consider the things that the reviewer is saying, you know, to see whether or not it's a legitimate cause for something that I need to change in future works or whatever. In fact, case in point, there were quite a lot of reviews about Along the Razor's Edge that said there was too much swearing in it. So I have literally gone back through it this last week and removed a bunch of swear words because
really?
I read through it and I agree, there is a lot of swearing in this book. So I went back and it's something I promised I'd never do, but I went back and sort of retconned a little bit and took away a bunch of swear words because it was a bit sweary. But that's due to actually a different edit where I went through the entire book and went,
There's no swearing in this. I was going to make it a bit too YA. I know, I'm going to add some swearing into the book. So this was before publication. I went through and I added loads of swearing into it, and I maybe went a little bit overboard.
Sure. I love the idea of a dedicated editing class just for swearing. I will agree. I do think that particularly in the first half of that, it feels like it's used as punctuation a little bit. But second half, I think the balance is great, and book two, the balance is great as well. So that's definitely a
positive sign. But the good news is, it's not used as punctuation anymore. The version, it's fine. Don't worry. Ignore that first one. But yeah, I feel that with bad reviews, actually time helps you distance yourself from them. I can read a bad review of Never Die Now and then just laugh about it. But if I read a bad review of Along the Razor's Edge at the moment, I'm kind of like, oh, they hate my book.
Yeah, it's definitely such a subjective and difficult thing that until you're in that moment, you don't really know how you're going to react.
Exactly. But distance helps you time helps you distance yourself from it. So I feel like...
Yes. Another question. I have no idea if this will go anywhere, but I'm curious. Do you hide any secrets or Easter eggs in your books that only a couple of people will find or perhaps adjust in there for yourself?
Yes. Tons. I'm a big one for hiding homages in my books, to be honest. Little things that are, they might be a small snippet of a line from something which has inspired me or a name of something. There's things like in my first Earth series, I think one of the books, I can't remember which one, there is a tavern called the Golden Fool, which is a direct homage to Robin Hobb. It's one of those things that has inspired me. I think one of the first lines in the first book, The Heresy Within, is "By fire be purged," which is a reference to World of Warcraft, which I spent many, many years playing. I love hiding little homages throughout it to the things that have inspired me throughout all my books. But then there'll also just be sort of little, I like hiding things like in Never Die, there's a bunch of little things which are hidden that just seem normal when you first read through, only when you read back through after knowing the ending, do they actually make sense into the larger narrative. So I like doing things like that, things that only make sense once you've already read the book and know how it turns out.
And that kind of gives you a reason to reread it a second or third time as well, because it becomes a different story as well.
Exactly.
So to wrap up this interview, I have really enjoyed this. I have my curiosity for your other books has been even more piqued than it already was. So what are you, we've discussed what you've been working on. Can you tell us a little bit about book three, the final book in the War Eternal trilogy, and when that's going to be out and what it is about?
Okay, so book three is releasing on May 26th, which is also my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Which wasn't really planned. I was intending to release it on the 25th, which would have been the last Monday of the month, but apparently that's a bank holiday in England, so I was just like, nah, that's not happening. So I released it on the 26th. Well, I'm releasing it on the 26th instead. It's the culmination of the trilogy. I'm trying to do it without any sort of spoilers or anything, but
a bit high.
it's very much the last portion of Eska growing up. So you know, book one is very much her as a teenager. Book two is maybe not in actual age, but it's themed around the idea that she's grown up into sort of in her 20s, and then book one she doesn't know who she is. Book two she's trying to figure out who she is, and book three she knows who she is. And this is her finally deciding to try and get her vengeance on everyone.
Excellent. That is going to be very exciting.
It's probably the most emotional of the three books, which is in a series that is quite emotional is hopefully saying something.
First two books have been a roller coaster, so.
Yeah. Shit goes down.
I'm excited. All right. Well, I think this is a good place to wrap up our chat. Rob, can you tell us where people can find you?
Okay. You can find me on my webpage, which is www.robjhayes.co.uk, or you can find me on Facebook at The Heresy Within, or you can find me on Twitter at Rob of the Hayes. I think that's pretty much it for my social media type stuff.
Excellent. I'll put links to all of those and everything else we've discussed in the show notes as well. Rob, thanks so much for coming on. I really enjoyed this chat.
Thanks for having me again. It's been a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Novel Analyst Podcast. In this episode, I mentioned that I was about 80% of the way through The Lessons Never Learned by Rob Hayes. I've since finished that book, and holy cow, it was fantastic. If you want to read my full review for the book, I have just become a reviewer for Booknest, which is one of the largest fantasy book review sites. I was going to say in the world, that sort of sounds a bit weird to say it, but I guess it's true. There's not many fantasy book review sites on Pluto, for instance. So from now on, I'm going to be posting very detailed, in-depth reviews on booknest.eu for every new book that I read, as long as it's a book that I think is worthy of reviewing. If it's horrendous and I didn't finish it, I probably won't post a review on there. So if you want to stay updated with my reviews on Booknest, you can go to bit.ly/JedReviews, all one word. I'll also have the link to that in the show notes. So that'll give you the link to my page on Booknest, which will have all of my current and future reviews once I get around to writing them. I've currently got reviews on there for Master of Sorrows by Justin Travis Call, Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, The Lessons Never Learned by Rob J. Hayes, Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett, and Oathbringer by Brandon Sanderson. They've already got, I think, well over 1,000 views between them all, which is pretty exciting, and it's nice to have the exposure of Booknest, and it's been really cool to connect with the other reviewers and authors on there. So if you want to check out my reviews, and you'll probably pick up some interesting writing advice lessons from those reviews as well, go to my Booknest page. Once again, that's bit.ly/JedReviews, and the link to that will be in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening. Now go and write extraordinary stories. I'll see you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.